Welcome to episode 25 of The Winning Agenda. Tonight, our panelists are three-time store champion and three-time Magic the Gathering Pro Tour competitor, Wilfie Horrig.
Hi, everyone. How are you?
And myself, 2014 Australian Nationals top 8 competitor, Brian Holland. Wilfie's been away for quite a few episodes. As we discussed last week, he's been away being a powerful wizard in the United States. So we thought we'd take this chance just to have a bit of one-on-one time with Wilfie, just to get him up to scratch and really get the total Wilfie minutes on the winning agenda. Sound good to you, Wilfie?
Yeah, that sounds great.
Well, I mean, one of the things I want to talk about was this Valencia deck that you've been toying around with lately. I know you said that you've only recently really gotten into deck building, and you seem to have dove around quite a little bit here. So why don't you talk us through a little bit about the idea of the deck?
Yeah, it's a little experimental, as you know, most decks are nowadays. It's trying to do something a bit different. The kind of genesis of it was when I saw people play Eater Keyhole in Max X, and
very popular build at the moment.
Yeah, and I thought Eater Keyhole is quite powerful, but it has some really severe drawbacks. One drawback is that even after you've, you know, milled 7 points worth of agendas, and because of Jackson you really need to do that in a short period of time, you still need to find a way to access archives, which, if your opponent knows what's up and is only protecting the servers that are most relevant against you, because Eater Keyhole is so restrictive, it will often take lots more resources, both in icebreakers, you need to find icebreakers to get into archives, and also in credits, because often the icebreakers that you play aren't that efficient because you're not set up to use the regular suite when you also have to host an eater and a keyhole. So I thought that blackmail was the obvious way to solve this problem.
Yeah. I must say that I've had a lot of testing games against max decks that are running Eater Keyhole, and it is that same problem. They just still need to be able to get in eventually to score those agendas that they're putting in archives. And the other additional issue that they have when relying on Hades Shard is that they, one, have to draw it, two, not mill it to Max's ability, and three, they still have to be able to play it at the opportune moment. So it's still fairly difficult. A lot of the time you find those decks just trying to grind you out to get, not necessarily to go to time, but to get to the point where they're just going to mill you, which is probably not the best strategy to go for, because it takes so long and the core can just win. So you think blackmail has been better option in that regard?
Yeah, because blackmail, while being an extremely powerful card on its own, in combination with Valencia's ability, obviously, solves both of the problems that the Eater Keyhole decks have, which is that it's hard to interact with their remotes because of how Eater works. It's hard to get into archives because hosting three memory worth of things in addition to icebreakers to get in really requires lots of resources, as I said earlier. And so I found my idea was that blackmail would solve those two problems perfectly, because if you would just never have any reason to run archives unless you're scoring points, then you would just keep it clear, and so you could always blackmail in, and you can use blackmail to make remotes a lot less safe for the corp. Of course, it's not the best solution to the problem of your opponent scoring through remotes, because, of course, you know, you have to expect that they will play an agenda to blackmail it, and you only have a limited number of blackmails, but it's definitely better than, you know, the regular Eater Keyhole strategy of just trying to ignore the remotes entirely, which I think is just an easy, really easy way to lose.
Yeah, no, I agree there 100%. So when you've been testing the deck out, how often is blackmail sort of working out for you in that remote when they go, like, install advance? Obviously, against Valencia, that never feels particularly good unless you've already got ice res to that server, which, if the Valencia player hasn't been running there, you won't have. And if they just install a blind card into that remote, are you sort of just hedging your bets, or are you obviously using your somewhat superior play skill to figure out whether or not that there would be opportune for them to put an agenda there for you to steal?
Yeah, so the deck has a couple of interlocking synergies. The first is that account siphon really works well with a blackmail plan, because you can siphon with Eater or Crypsis, which is basically just a secondary Eater. You can siphon them and then run their remote, which saves you the problem of having to use a blackmail at all. And of course, sometimes you do have to play that guessing game, you know, did they play an agenda? But if you, say, siphon them and then they spend lots of money trying to protect HQ, and you can put them down to where they can't score their agenda next turn, regardless of what happens, that's one way to solve the problem without necessarily having to take a gamble. But of course, sometimes you will have to just blackmail, and sometimes it'll be something that's not relevant. But you, between blackmail, same old thing, and deja vu, and planned assault, you have enough blackmails that they always have to be wary of the threat of you being able to access blackmail, even if you don't necessarily have one in hand. And so they always have to play around that, and might not necessarily be as aggressive with playing 3-for-2s as they might if they know, of course, that you don't have blackmail or something like that.
Well, I know that we're only a few minutes into this episode, but I can already hear people typing up a post on Reddit to tell you that your entire plan is defunct because it dies to executive boot camp. Have you tested against boot camp at all?
I have, actually.
Do you think it would be an issue for you? Was it an issue for you?
Our friend, Tim.
Oh, yes, Tim. There's your shout-out.
A big, dumb baby, indeed.
The big, dumb baby, yes.
We were playing some games where he was playing executive boot camp and Elizabeth Mills, which, you know, both are a problem for blackmail, of course, but the deck has a very reasonable plan of just trying to siphon them and use the resources to keyhole them to death, regardless of being able to blackmail them or not. And so even if they can score out a couple of agendas, you can present enough pressure, enough time pressure and resource pressure to try and race them if they're spending all their resources on trying to create a server. And the fact that the bootcamp Elizabeth Mills decks usually can't score from hand is another thing that they need to get Elizabeth Mills set up before they can start scoring. They can't, you know, score something and then use Elizabeth Mills to get rid of the bad pub whenever they want. They really have to first get rid of the bad pub so you can't blackmail them, and then only then can they start making a scoring server.
So it's very clunky for them still.
I mean, it's not the worst because those two, like Elizabeth Mills and Bootcamp, are quite efficient, but it hasn't been that much of a problem because, you know, you often have time to expect what they're going to do and go into the secondary mode of just ignoring their emotes entirely and trying to keyhole them as fast as possible. And so I'll just go over what the deck wants to do in, you know, outside of these.
Yeah, of course.
Outside of what I've talked about. It's just a kind of slow resource advantage control deck. One synergy is Inject in combination with Deja Vu and same old thing, which we all know is a really powerful way to both find economy and card draw that you need while filtering out the programs that you don't need until you need them and you can Deja Vu them back. And so that sort of gives you a lot of card and credit flow throughout the game, in addition to Daily Cast, Earthrise Hotel, Shore Gamble, I've Had Worse, Dirty Laundry, Day Job, which we're all used to by now in terms of building your resources. So how I found games usually go is because of the threat of blackmail, they have to play a little bit more defensively, and if they can score from hand, you try and siphon them as much as possible, because usually decks that can score from hand and decks that can punish you for having tags don't go together at all, and then you try and siphon them as much as possible until they don't have any resources, then keyhole them to death, and if they can punish you for having tags, then you usually don't, they usually don't score from hand, so you can prevent them from making a remote, so you have all the time in the world, basically, to set up a situation where you have lots of cards, lots of credits, can siphon them a couple times, and then start keyholing them.
So it sounds like you might have, well, I mean, being a control deck, you're aiming to go for the long game, so it does sound like you might have a bit of an issue against aggro corp decks that are looking to something like, obviously, Near Earth Hub. Corp can threaten to score lots of points early. Does that put a big hole in your overall game plan, or is there something you can do to still sort of work around that?
Well, you have enough. Of course, that is a problem for a kind of deck that's trying to go very long, and I'd say that's probably the main problem with this deck, is that it's not really built to be very aggressive early, although with Data Sucker and Parasite, you can sort of do that a bit better. If Data Sucker allows you to get resources from running, you can run a bit more earlier and score some more points. So I think those two cards are much more important against aggressive corp decks than against controlling corp decks, where you just want to build up resources and don't want to run that much. And of course, Siphon is still very good against those kind of decks because they don't usually have the resources to score and protect their HQ a lot. And of course, they don't run that many large ice in general, but you know, you do have to find the siphon before they kill you, because you're on quite a quick clock. But you have, you know, so much card and credit gain gaining ability that, from what I've found, it hasn't been a huge problem, but some games, they just outrace you and there's nothing really that you can do about it.
That sounds really good. So, since you've come back from the States and you've been checking out at least the local Melbourne meta, which is obviously very influenced by the online community, how have you found things, in terms of, you've tried the Max X deck that we put together, and now you're trying Valencia Estevez. Have you thought about trying any of the noise lists that we've seen around? The virus spam decks, things like that. The other control lists. What did you think there?
Well, Jesse's been working on a noise deck that I've found to be quite good, although he hasn't quite. It's a bit less controlling than the Valencia deck, so it has the kind of consistency problems where you don't really have the huge resource gain to be able to go late, and so you're a bit more at the mercy of your opening hand. But I'm sure he can talk more about that, and will at some point. But I found that the kind of all-in noise decks where you're just very slow and you just want to not necessarily entirely mill them out, but mostly create pressure through your ability.
These are the kind of decks that sort of spam all their one-cost viruses onto a Scheherazade and get them back with the Deja Vu, those kind of decks, and that they sort of play like Autoscripter and just plan to never run.
Yeah, exactly. Those kind of combo decks I found are just not that. I would say that this Valencia deck is a bit of an evolution of those kind of strategies, but I've tried to solve the fundamental non-interactivity problem that, those kind of decks just give your opponent as much time and as much resources as they want to do whatever they want. And so if you can't execute your plan fast enough, they just run you over. And so by using Siphon and Blackmail, I found that those are two really, really powerful ways to kind of get around that problem.
So some people would argue that they've had a lot of success with these particular noise lists. Why would you say that the lack of interaction is a bad thing?
Well, the main problem with decks, this Valencia deck suffers from this a little bit, and it's been something that I've been thinking about, is that the slower and slower you get, the less relevant your opponent's opening hand is. I know that might seem strange, but what I mean is that if you're planning for the game to go, 10 or 20 turns, then what cards are in your opening hand and in your opponent's opening hand can maybe not even matter. And so it's not like the aggressive decks where, if your opponent is forced to can't find a Crota and they have to draw many times to try and find it, then they're on really severe time pressure to find it or else they die. Against you, it's a lot more of a resource generating game. So if their hand is not that strong, it doesn't matter because they're going to see lots more cards before they're forced to have something.
Well, that's very true. I suppose I've been in a lot of situations, music they were talking about, but against some noise lists where I've been playing a mid-range corp deck that ideally wants to go a bit longer, and maybe I've mulliganed into a subpar hand, and I'm quite relieved to see that my opponent has decided not to interact with me really at all, apart from maybe installing some viruses and making me mill a couple of cards. I've still got plenty of time to maybe draw those extra pieces of ice or that economy that I need before I really need that ice or that economy.
Exactly, yeah. And so I've tried to solve that problem a little bit, especially by playing Siphon, which is just such a strong interactive card and can really punish an opponent who doesn't have that strong a hand and maybe can't present two ice on HQ, or maybe has split one ice on HQ, one ice on R&D, and you can just get either and start the Siphon train going, or however you want to say it.
Would you say then that playing a control deck, obviously you're giving up the early game impetus, as we always say, but would you say that there's that extra caveat of taking the pressure off your opponent and giving them time to set up is maybe an extra drawback that control decks have that maybe isn't matched in any sort of drawback that mid-range or aggro decks have?
Yeah, exactly. I would say that that's probably one of the more fundamental things of playing control decks from either the runner or the corp side. But of course, it's a bit more relevant from the runner side because, the corp mulligans can be a little higher variance.
In the sense that they have the potential to mulligan and then bring more than 7 points into the game from the very beginning.
Yeah, of course, it matters from both the runner and the corp side, but from the corp side, if you mulligan and your hand is not good and your opponent starts threatening you from turn one like a lot of aggressive or mid-range runner decks do, then often you can just lose the game before you have any chance to get anywhere, really. And so the equivalent from the runner side is if the runner, has a bad hand and then mulligans and the corp tries to pressure them, then even cards which aren't necessarily good in the early game, like a specific sort of breaker, might be good against the co-op. Like, if the co-op goes like Paperwall, which is the archetypical aggressive card, and tries to score from it, even if your hand as the runner isn't good in most situations, you might still have a Corroder to break past the Paperwall. Whereas there's not really that same sort of opposing structure where a co-op can have a card that's very good against a runner who has a bad hand or whatever.
Yeah,
That makes sense, I think.
I think that's true. Like, I mean, would you say that that extra caveat would stop you from taking a control deck to a high level event?
Oh no, definitely not. I still think there are, like, especially with that the Valencia deck that I'm working on now is definitely a control deck, but I would say that's something you have to be mindful of, that you want, it's really good to have cards which can pressure your opponent early, even if you are a control deck.
Yeah, no, I personally, I think controlling co-op decks in particular are in a really good spot at the moment because, like, there are a lot of aggro runners around there at the moment, in particular, like, some max and even some noise builds that we've seen, like, really aggressive builds. And in our meta, at least, Andromeda is making a little bit of a comeback. But the thing about aggro decks is that, when we've spoken about this, is that they get to a point where they run out of gas, and if the co-op can stay alive until that point, and you're playing a controlling deck, then you get over that hump, and then you get back in the game, and that's the inevitability that you'll win it. Have you sort of felt the same with the meta post Order and Chaos?
Yeah, exactly. It's a sort of balancing act where, you don't want to be too aggressive or you'll run out of steam in the late game, and you don't want to be too controlling or you won't be able to punish your opponent in the early game. It's of course, we all know this kind of concept, but it's something which has been really on my mind lately with this Valencia deck. And I just say that in general, the appropriate thing is to just try and be balanced, like to try and maybe put cards in your aggressive decks that are strong on their own, but especially strong if you have to play a long game and are flexible in doing that. And like in the Valencia deck, Account Siphon is the perfect thing for that because it fuels your economy so well as the game goes longer, even though it kind of tapers off after a certain point. If they have enough on HQ, you just can't use it at all. But for most of the game, it's very strong, and it also has the secondary capability of to be able to pressure a co-op early, even though you don't usually pressure the co-op early.
So, I mean, do you think you can make those changes as you're suggesting by putting a card which is by itself good but also good in the long game into an aggro deck without sort of diluting your overall strategy? Like, just go back to our sort of maybe our synergy versus overall power discussion?
Yeah, it's, I mean, all these concepts are like connected in some way. It's kind of hard to specifically articulate what particular points I'm talking about, but like for example in the Gabe deck, the Spanish influenza deck, which is something that I've been working on and I think I might revisit now that Order and Chaos is out, but that's I think a topic for another episode because I know that you said that Eater might be good in it and I'm tending to agree.
Oh yes, Eater over the Crypsis,
yeah, I mean
correct?
there's lots of ways you can go, but Eater is just really powerful with those strategies. But anyway, so maybe a card like John Masanori, which can be really good if you come out of the gates really blazing with with a resource advantage, but can also, make your runs, if you start falling behind, it can make your runs a bit more efficient. And if you always play around the drawback by, say, having a Crypsis counter or whatever, then it can kind of claw you back into a game by allowing you to still do the things that are good for you to do while not being that bad when you're doing the things that you do want to do. So, if your opponent is trying to stack multiple ice on HQ, as most of them do, then because you have to get into HQ at some point to win, Masanori makes it a bit better. And if they issue ice from other servers to protect HQ better, then you can use Masanori to gain some advantage there. So, it's a kind of flexible card. Of course, it has a drawback, but in the way you kind of want to play the deck, it's a flexible card because it's really good, really, really good when you're doing the things you want to do, and it can, help you get back into a game where you're not doing the things you want to do.
Another one of the things I wanted to touch on, just while it was you and me, is there's a conversation that came up about you actually when you weren't around. I was talking to a friend of ours, and we were talking about how obviously you're a very, very good Magic player, and he made the comment that you're a good Magic player because you only ever make the most optimal play. And obviously, I think that's what everybody would aspire to do, but I think with you in particular, it's more often than not true, barring a few circumstances. And obviously, like, I think there's a few, that's an obvious good philosophy to apply to any competitive card game. So I imagine you apply that same sort of philosophy to Netrunner. Now, my question is here that Netrunner is also a game of bluffs and such, and I would make the argument that bluffing is not necessarily the optimal play, but you get to a point where if you're playing against somebody who is very good, they can sort of figure out what the most optimal play for you, and then bluffing would be to do the opposite of that. Do you ever make bluffs?
Well, I mean, like, it goes back a little bit to, I think in the episode where Owen was on, there was some talk about bluffing, and he made a good point, which is that you should bluff by your actions. You know, the kind of information trading with your opponent is what...
Through body language, do you mean?
No. I mean, like, information trade... Not, like, your actions, like, specifically to exclude your you know, physical actions, but your in-game actions is what I'm referring to. So, like,
oh, yeah, sure.
Yeah, like, so, for example, if I put something unprotected in a new server on turn one, then that, you know, starts a game of information with my opponent, and my opponent has to work out, you know, did I do that because it's an agenda I want to score it? Did I do it because it's a, you know, Jackson or an Adonis that I want to get, you know, start using as soon as possible? For example, if I'm playing Nirith Hub, could it have been possible that I just played like a Sansan, which is totally useless now, but gives me the ability to draw a card and will be in play to start developing my board later. And so in all those situations, there's a kind of thing where, you know, do I want to run it just to see what it is? Do I want to run it in the case that it might be something that I really want to trash? For example, a Melange or whatever, unprotected, you know, you might usually want to trash. And so that kind of information trading is something which is really important to Netrunner, and I think bluffing is, you know, sort of subset of that, where you do something which plays off what you think your opponent has in terms of information on you. So, like, if I think that my opponent thinks that I would never play an unprotected agenda, and for those who know me, I would basically never play an unprotected agenda,
yeah.
But an efficient bluff would be to play an unprotected agenda in a situation where I think my opponent's very unlikely to check it because it would be very inefficient.
And
for
you've
them.
Done that to me. So
what's up?
I'm sure you've done that to me at some stage. You have, on your first turn, installed a face-down agenda in a new remote, unprotected. Pass turn to me, and I've thought, well, I'm playing Andromeda. I've got 9 cards in hand. I'm playing Wilfie Horrig, who would never do something as brazen as to put an unprotected 3/2 in a remote on turn one. So I'm not even going to waste my time. I'm going to play 4 of my 9 cards, and then I'm going to pass turn. And then you've scored a beta test. Or then you've scored, you know, something like that.
Exactly.
Is that what you're talking about,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, like, exactly.
I'm like, oh, for fuck's sake. Like,
and so, yeah, bluffing really works off this information thing, but also, you know, it has to be not good. It can't just be free for your opponent to call you a bluff. I see lots of people, you know... Oh, I mean, I don't know if I see lots of people, but as an example,
yeah.
People, you know, might play Adonis or something unprotected. Like, usually it's good to play an Adonis unprotected, so if your opponent trashes it, it's okay, and if your opponent doesn't trash it, you can get a head start on it so you can protect it with an ice next turn, especially if you're playing Engineering in the Future. But if your opponent has, for example, Desperado or something like that, it's a lot lower value for you to do that because it's much freer for them to call you a bluff, you know, if it even is a bluff.
Yeah,
like,
and this comes back to the conversation that we had in the episode when Owen was on, the one you referenced, and the philosophy that I applied, one that I still stand by, is that you should always try and call your opponent's bluff if it's not going to cost you too much in terms of, you know, resources.
Exactly, which is where the information, you know, trading game and the resource trading game kind of, you know, coexist, where if I check your remote, I'm trading a click for the information of what it is, and if I really value my resources, as you usually do in the early games, it might be good for your opponent to play an agenda there because it's so unlikely. And you know, all these things have kind of linked together.
Would you ever be in the situation where you would make a bluff, or would you do what you could to find a more optimal play than a bluff? Is bluff
right?
Like
right,
a last...
I see.
Yeah.
Actually, I do have one more situation I want to talk about.
Okay, go for it.
There was a situation in a game against Shilzy where I was playing his next design deck. For those who don't know, it's a kind of like hyper-aggressive corp deck which uses Mushin no Shin, basically only to score agendas very early. He has now added Junebug, but when I was playing it, there was no Junebug, and it was his deck, so he knew this, and we were just playing some games, you know, randomly.
And you didn't look through it to see what was there?
Oh, I did look through it.
Okay, sure.
And so we're playing a game, I'm a bit behind. I can't remember what exactly, but he has his setup, most of his rig or whatever. And it looks like I'm gonna die slowly. And I mush in an something in an unprotected remote and then pass the turn or whatever. And he just runs it and he's like, because he knows it's an agenda
Because it's
and
his deck, yeah.
because it's his deck and he doesn't have any June bugs or whatever. And I pack up my cards and he's like, why'd you do that? And I'm like, I still think it's the best thing to do. Like overall, if you're gonna play a random opponent in a random tournament, you basically. If I have any chance of winning, it's going to be to score that agenda, so I have to do it. Even if they might know that I don't have any traps in my deck, it's still right to do it because it, they might. Basically, if you have to do it to win, then you have to do it regardless of how good it is to do, basically.
Yeah, this actually sort of feeds a little bit into a conversation I got into with Jesse a couple of months ago off the air, and we're talking about the idea. We play all these tournaments, we go to different places, we play people we've never met before, and you think sometimes it's very hard to tell what your opponent's going to think of you. For instance, as I was saying, like when you and I play, I know that you would never play an unprotected agenda on turn one, but you've done that because, things like that. Does your philosophy about, checking bluffs or making bluffs change when you're playing people that you do not know at all? Like, I mean, or is it still just you should always make the most optimal play? You shouldn't play around somebody who you think maybe has a tell or is sort of
Well,
gotten to a pattern of the actions they're making.
I mean, in general, like you should make the most optimal play is a kind of like blanket rule, but it comes back to the whole information thing where, if you're playing someone that you don't know, then you can't really make as many inferences about what they'll do, and
So,
so.
I mean, for example, all right, say you're playing Near Earth Hub, and you have a Sansan in a remote, but you maybe draw into a 3 for 2 in a later turn. You think, well, hold on, this guy doesn't really know me. He may think that I'm actually playing like the horizontal build. What I'll do is install a couple of remotes. One of them will be a 3 for 2, and he won't run them, and I'll be on 6 points next turn. Even though that's something you would never do, is that something you would advise people against doing just because they don't know what their opponent is like?
Well, I mean, I would say that in general, if you don't know, you should just play to the best of your ability. I don't know
See
how
what I'm
to
saying?
say.
Because this would give you a massive advantage because you
Yeah,
can
yeah,
score
yeah,
for
yeah.
free, but it's the risk is higher. So is that to you like a less optimal play than just playing as you normally would?
I mean, then I think you'd have to look at things like, how far behind am I in the game? And what sort of things are going to happen if my opponent does decide to check the remote? Like, who your opponent is doesn't really matter, but you can think of them as some, like.
An amorphous Netrunner machine.
No. What I mean is, you can think of them as a sort of distribution of probabilities. Like,
Okay,
I
sure.
mean, I don't know if that makes sense, but
It
like,
does, yeah.
you can think of like, if you don't know your opponent, then it's a lot harder to tell what they'll do. And but I would say that most people generally would try and check unprotected remotes against, an unknown opponent, especially if they don't look like they're playing any traps or whatever, because the risk, like the cost is so high. It, not the cost is so high, but the drawback is so high if you do let your opponent score an unprotected 3 for 2, especially against NBN. So, I can think most people are going to check my remotes because they know, or you assume that they know, that it's really good for me to score an unprotected 3 for 2. It basically puts you so far ahead in the game, especially if it's AstroScript. And so, I would think that without knowing anything about my opponent, I would assume that they were going to check. But if the game had progressed a little more, and they haven't been checking my remotes, maybe I think they're a little more sure that I am playing a horizontal deck with lots of assets, but maybe they think the same thing and they're just waiting for you to play another turn of remotes to check. Like, that's a common thing that happens with horizontal decks, or more horizontal decks with less ice, is that you play a couple remotes early, you score out of one of them, that's okay, and then each subsequent remote that you play, your opponent checks because they think, they can't.
Let that happen again.
Yeah, like it's so. Yeah, exactly. Like now that they know that you will score unprotected easily, they have to check every remote that you have from then on or whatever. So it's those kind. All these factors kind of, go together.
That's all the time we have tonight. for the Winning Agenda. If you want to get in contact with us, you can do so by shooting us an email to thewinningagenda@gmail.com. You can check us out on Facebook. Our like page is The Winning Agenda, or hit us up on the fan favorite Twitter. Our handle is @WinningAgenda. Once again, thanks to Wilfie for being on the show. Hopefully he's constantly going to be on the show for the rest of eternity now. He's not going to go and play Magic again. Have you qualified for anything else for Wilfie, or something coming up?
We'll leave that a question for another time.
Yeah, right. Okay, thanks guys, and thanks so much for listening. We'll be back next Monday as always.
Yep,
cheers.
Thanks. Thanks for listening to half an hour of me ramble on. Do we know who else rambles on?
Who?
The all-in noise decks where you want to just...
You're laughing, what's funny?
Bro, yeah, just the idea of just drawing 40 cards and then starting to play things. Yeah.